Mr. Worth, if you would, tell us a little bit about what it means to be an entrepreneur and how you express the entrepreneurial mindset.
Well, to me, being an entrepreneur means being me. That's who I am. That's who I've always been. It's the essence of my personality. It's part of my personality for different reasons. For me, I've always seen the future actually better than the present or the past. So being an entrepreneur says, you know what, this product could be improved by doing this. Or the consumer isn't getting this, and you know what, I'm going to bet they want it. Or what's missing in this picture? Being an entrepreneur means creating a product with a unique selling proposition to it and having a passion for that product so strong so that you can overcome the obstacles of an entrepreneur, which are major, okay? You have to have passion. You have to have a competitive spirit, second to none. You have to want to get into a war, okay? You have to expect one. You have to plan for one. You have to, all the components, there's so many components to being an entrepreneur. And primarily, the things that you need to start with is a product or a service. And whether it's been my underground irrigation business or my jam business or whatever, you start with a product and service that's better than what's there, okay? Secondly, you believe it, that it's better than what's there. Thirdly, you make sure that the consumer believes it too, that your customer believes it too. Fourthly, you have enough passion to drive that belief, even if you're ahead of the time, which I have been in my past. You drive that belief, even if you're ahead of that time, till its proper end, till the consumer say, yes, he's right, I want that too, okay? Being an entrepreneur means having a product, planning its execution, planning its financing, planning its the people around you that you need. There's a whole series of steps to proper entrepreneurialism, including identifying the emotive trigger to that successful purchase chain decision, identifying how to brand that product or service so that word of mouth becomes like a Häagen-Dazs, okay? You know, when you think of Häagen-Dazs, you think of great ice cream. When you think of Kleenex, you know, branding that product. There's a whole series of events that surround being an entrepreneur, and not wanting to have a boss is one of the components of being an entrepreneur. Not wanting to have somebody above you that isn't as smart as you, okay? There's a lot of things.
Now, I find that answer very interesting because when I pose the same question to a different entrepreneur, they seem to be dumbfounded and stumped when I mention the phrase entrepreneurial mindset. I'm looking at your resume, and I'm seeing that your BA was in psychology. Why do you think such a phrase stumps those who are supposed to be entrepreneurs?
I'm not sure they were entrepreneurs. They may have had their own business, okay? There's a difference between being an entrepreneur and having your own business. It's like the fine line on the word warrior. You know, one's a warrior with an O, and one's a warrior with an A. In entrepreneurial difference, the being stuck, I mean, heck, I was just half going there, okay, as far as what the attributes are necessary. And it's built into you. It's either built into you from the beginning or you learn it. And if you're interviewing entrepreneurs who have already been successful, perhaps it's the people around them that are making them successful and making their idea or their technical product a success. Perhaps it's the people around them who have the passion. It's perhaps the people around them who have the financial expertise to keep the controls and the reporting systems correct so that you're not out of control. I mean, if people are having trouble answering that question, I question whether they're truly entrepreneurs. They may be situational entrepreneurs. Let's call them that. Because a real entrepreneur doesn't, I mean, there are so many attributes that a real entrepreneur is and has to be. He has to wear a lot of hats. Then he has to delegate some of those hats when he's weak in them. A real entrepreneur doesn't stutter when you ask him that question. You have to interrupt him. Because he'll go on. Okay? Like you should interrupt me right now.
Well, since you said it, Richard, I'm going to do that, and I'm going to throw someone into the interview that I think can appreciate it. It was Sun Tzu. You talked about how passion and planning is necessary for an entrepreneur. I want to give you some of his wisdom from Art War. He says, he will win who knows how to handle both superior and inferior forces. Does that have any applicability?
I'm sorry. He who wins...
He will win who knows how to handle both superior and inferior forces. Does that
That's
have
correct.
Any applicability for the entrepreneur?
That's correct. No playing fields alike. And within a battle, within a war, you'll be faced with seemingly inferior forces that have more strength than superior forces. And you will be faced, such as I was, in my cookie business, you know, with a billion-dollar company, capable of buying every shelf there was. Or my jam business, of a $500 million company. Or you'll be faced with companies that are small, but have their act together. And those companies can either be tougher than the big boys. You can dance around the legs of those big boys. The little guys, you got to pay attention to because they can dance as fast as you can. Okay? So I think what you're asking me is how versatile do I have to be as an entrepreneur because you're facing different types of challenges and opponents with different forms of strengths and weaknesses. And you need to be prepared. The big issue is for a really smart entrepreneur is to go through the what if process. Okay? What if this happens? Very similar to a break even analysis, okay? Which says, conservatively speaking, if I have this amount of fixed costs, this amount of variable costs, and those are third party endorsed, I will break even when I do this. And is it realistic that I will do that kind of volume? Okay? Your question becomes, are you prepared for one type of army or are you prepared for the swamp fox? Are you prepared for both? And if you're only prepared for one type of creature, guess what? The other guy may put you right on your back.
I think a martial artist would appreciate your ending part of that answer there, Richard. Since you brought it up,
look at
your experience here, and there are a number of companies I would love to delve into, but that name Fruity is just sticking in my mind. Tell us a little bit about this Fruity Cookie Company as part of the entrepreneurial landscape.
Well, the IW Fruity Company came when I was doing Sorrel Ridge Jams and Jellies. And one day it came to me that are very simple thoughts, okay? If Richard Wirth had created the concept of good-for-you eating, that people would pay more for jams without sugar, naturally, okay? Not with artificial, but naturally. Well, if they would do that, then logic followed. If they will do that, why won't they do that for cookies? So Richard sweetened his jam with fruit juice. Now, a name is very important, okay? Names allow you to market. Häagen-Dazs has nothing to do with Sweden. Trust me. It's just a weird name that sounds like it's cold and vanilla, okay? It has nothing to do with it. Now, and Sorrel Ridge was tough to market herself. I said, I want a name that describes the product and is memorable to make it easier for me this time around. So I'm going to sweeten my cookies with fruit juice. So fruit plus cookies equal frookies. And since I was born frooked up and had a relapse, it made it real easy. Okay? and it was funny. It was funny, these frookies. We created a language out of it, okay? Like, for instance, we'd go to buyers. And we get focus groups. And, you know, the focus group said when 3 out of 10 women, I mean, we knew that who the guardians of the gate at the grocery store are women, okay? So when 3 out of 10 said it's too sexy, we said we've got a winner. That's it. Shut it down. Let's launch. Because sex sells, okay? But it was subliminal sex, okay? And so we'd go to a buyer, and we'd turn the name Frookies into a language. We'd give them 3 buttons, and we'd say to that buyer, okay, by the end of this meeting, you're going to wear one of these buttons. One button will say, I'm all frooked up. One button will say, I'm hooked on frooks. One button will say, go frook yourself. You have the opportunity and the freedom to wear any button. So the name actually became a language, okay? And it became a consumer language as well. So memorable, all right? So RW Frookies, the good for you cookies, it's both rhythmic and it describes the product. It made it much easier. There were guys like Health Valley with, you know, fruit juice sweetened cookies that came later. But, you know, this made it, you know, we turned them into Death Valley. I mean, we called them Death Valley, okay? You can actually start a national rumor. By the time we were done, it took us 2 years to have their own salespeople, they were our competition, calling themselves Death Valley, okay? A name's very important. So that's how RW Frookies came into play as a name, as a product. It came from the success, dynamic parallel of another product. It was like a logarithm. If A plus B equals C, then if A is, you know, looks like A, then B and C will occur. If Sorrel Ridge was sweetening itself with sugar, it was successful, was taking 10% market share, why wouldn't cookies do the same? That Sorrel Ridge was really the market innovator and took and changed the way people bought groceries, okay? But Frookies capitalized on it.
Now, I love the name, Richard. Now, tell me how RW Frookies, did that morph into the Delicious Fruity Cookie Company?
I'm sorry, I didn't get the last sentence.
Did RW Frookies, did that morph into the Delicious Fruity Cookie Company? Are these two separate entrepreneurs?
Yeah, they were two separate companies, yes. Sorrel Ridge Jam
Jelly
is two separate
Delicious Fruity Cookie Company.
The Delicious Fruity Company was part of our M&A strategy, mergers and acquisition strategy, we actually got into bidding for Keebler within 6 years, we were bidding from a $500,000 investment. We were bidding with Wasserstein Perella and the other largest M&A guy on Wall Street, $500 million for Keebler. And we did not get that bid. And the reason we didn't get that bid is because Richard had to stay in Long Island when he bought Delicious. We became the number five cookie company in the United States, about $75 million worth of volume. We had cookies named, we had all the licenses, Nestle's Butterfingers, Chiquita Banana Cookies, Skippy Peanut Butter Cookies, Barnum & Bailey Cookies, Trolls, Power Rangers. We had become, I mean, we had both sides of the cookie event, the hedonistic and the healthy. And we were ready to go and get Keebler, but I had to put, and this is one thing that people need to understand about being an MBA, okay? By having an MBA, it is not necessarily a guarantor of success in the entrepreneurial and or business field. Sorry to tell you that. To all you MBA people who think that by getting an MBA, it can be helpful, but it also can be hurtful. And so what I did, because my kids were in Long Island and the largest part of my company was operating out of Chicago, made a Harvard MBA and CPA and brand manager from Quaker Oats, my president. Well, this guy proceeded to lose $5 million in 4 months. So that only cost me $1 billion. It's a great lesson, though. Okay? But he was simply buying cookies for a buck, selling them for a buck and a quarter, and spending $1.50 doing it. Period. So it doesn't necessarily follow that formal training, okay? Formal training augmented by the entrepreneurial skills and instincts, et cetera, is the ultimate combination. All right?
Now, Richard, your commentary on MBAs, I find that very interesting because I looked at your history and I see that you have a bachelor's in psychology, no master's. You're making me think of something Robert Kiyosaki said when he was at Xerox. And he said they wouldn't promote me because I didn't have an MBA. I'm the top salesman in the company. He says, what difference does it make? And I quit and left. Give us some insight on why people think the pedigree of education will equate to success in the business world.
Well, I think if you see, I mean, let's go over history. Do you think Henry Ford was an MBA?
No.
Do you think Ted Turner was an MBA? Do you think Howard Hughes was an MBA? Do you think Steve Jobs is an MBA? I mean, do you think, and ultimately Einstein flunked sixth grade math, okay? Are we getting the picture here? Okay? Now, that does not mean that you can't get something from formal training. But I know numbers like nobody's business. I can give you your balance sheet within 20 minutes of you telling me some salient facts about yourself. Okay? But I do not know how, I do not do spreadsheets, algebra, geometry, or whatever. Okay? And there were some things in psychology like statistics that helped me out. But there's nothing wrong with formal training, but it is not the total event that makes you successful and the proof of that. Just look around at the successful entrepreneurs. Ben Cohen of Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream. I mean, the guy was a hippie, okay? He didn't have no MBA. Just look around. some of the key characteristics of, and I, probably the teacher's going to kill me now. These teachers are going to murder me. But fortunately, in our department, one of the cool things, and the reason why I even considered this program, is because every guy I've met in Western has been an entrepreneur. Okay?
Right.
Now, had they not been, I don't think I could listen to them.
Right.
How's that?
Right.
Every guy has been in with boots on the ground. Every guy, I think, so far that I've met, okay, knows the importance of instinct or of getting with the community. In the MBA program, are you taught to go to get involved with your community? Well, you, Prince John, above anybody, I've never seen a resume that says getting involved with the community more than you. It's unbelievable. So, but does an MBA program teach you how to do that? No. Does an MBA program teach you to put Rocky One in your ears, okay, or Eye of the Tiger before you walk into a buyer's office? So by the time you go through the door, the fact that you're going through the door, the guy's dead meat, okay? No. No. But are those tools useful? And when you have organization around you, you're going to want a CFO that knows, that formally knows her stuff, his or her stuff.
Right.
Not somebody who's just playing it. There are some positions you have to train formally for, okay? But as an entrepreneurial leader, it's about belief and not necessarily formal skill set. And that belief has to be transmitted to the customer in a way in which the customer himself already or herself already believes it or is made to believe it through your passion, okay? But if there's a communication there, there's an uncommunication there where the product is already accepted within that person. Aristotle, I think it was Aristotle or Plato, said all knowledge comes from within, and you just pull it out. Well, people, when I started Soil Rich, people thought sugar cost more than fruit. They weren't ready. But within 5 years, they said, this is a superior product because it's the fruit and nothing but the fruit. Okay? And that was my saying with Burl Ives. I came up with it. And, you know, it was like the truth and nothing but the truth. And that rang in the fruit and nothing but the fruit. But do you have to have formal training? I think it helps. Is it a requirement for success? Empirically, no.
That's an incredible response. I want to pick up on the thread that you gave us about transmitting your passion, because I see that you're doing quite a bit of public speaking. In my experience, I'm normally very unimpressed with the public speaking that I see, particularly those that seem to have rehearsed it or are reading. Tell us a little
right.
bit about your public speaking experiences and what you normally convey to your audience and your style.
The worst speech I ever gave, okay? I've spoken in front of 15 people. I've spoken in front of 25,000 people. And on television, I've spoken in front of 20 million, okay?
Right.
And a week and a half ago, I spoke in front of 50 entrepreneurial students, just as much of a thrill as being on ABC 2020, okay? The worst speech I ever gave was introducing Gloria Vanderbilt. She wanted me to do her salad dressings, and I got impressed, okay? I got impressed with her name and blah, 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 and blah, blah. And I wrote a speech. Halfway through the speech, I looked up and knew that I had lost that crowd. It was gone. And getting out of it was no way. However, now, I mean, there is a difference what I normally do, because of passion, is write down six or seven things, just in case I get lost, okay? In the speech, just in case I get lost. And what I will do, if I start to float, is go back to that list and come back into the speech, okay? And come back into the order. Now, when I get up and speak, I will believe in what I'm saying. And they will know that I believe in what I'm saying. And my understanding through, and we'll talk about this with you, is that you're quite a public speaker too. And, you know, when I did the Avis commercial, okay, for instance, there was 100 interviews with 100 of the most prominent entrepreneurs in America. And I had to be on the spot, the most passionate, with a message, okay? And I get up, and during my interview, which was taped, okay, by a professional taping company, I said, nobody works like an owner, nobody cares like an owner. When they heard that, they said, we've got our boy, okay? We've got our boy. And when I got up, Byram & Bailey made me the honorary ringmaster. We licensed the name Byram & Bailey Cookies. Now, this is before Cirque du Soleil beat the crap out of them. They were the number one entertainment company in the world. This is in the early 90s. And so the first speech, I got up in Fort Worth. There was 25,000 people there, okay? So I said, what am I going to say? This is like 30 seconds before I get in there. I know what I'm going to say. Sometimes it's only 30 seconds, all right? Sometimes that can be a mistake, and I'll show you that. I get up and I said, in my most country language, that, you know, redneck language that you ever heard, I said, my name is Richard Worth, and my great-great-great-granddaddy founded this town. Now, 25,000 people get up on their feet and give me a standing ovation because they think my great-great-great-granddaddy founded Fort Worth. My name is Richard Worth. I pulled it off. And then I motioned for them to sit down, and in the microphone I said, just kidding. That got their attention. Now, didn't it? Okay? So the guy behind me, and my head of sales, the ringmaster, who was probably a ringmaster at Byram & Bailey had to be the best entertainer in the world, okay? And he said to my sales girl, my sales manager, he says, this guy's no rookie, is he? You know, because most guys would get up and say, oh, I'm proud to be affiliated with Byram & Bailey and whatever, you know, something that bored me and made everybody in the crowd want to have the show go on, you know, not me. They wanted me to keep going. Now, one mistake I made by not being slightly prepared, okay, was I was on CNN and it was early on, and I didn't think there was many people going to be watching live. So when the camera guy says 15, 14, 13, Richard, with his big mouth, asked the interviewer how many people live were going to watch this interview right at that second. Well, she says 2.5 million. My tongue went into the back of my throat. Okay? And I couldn't get it out. So it's 14, 13, 12, 11. And then I start with a cough. And now, you can't see it. It's on my video. Nobody can see it. I faked it. But really, I was choking on my own tongue. Okay? I wasn't prepared. All right? That was a dumb question to ask 15 seconds before an interview. Now, when talking in front of ABC, you knew there was 20 million people going to be seeing you. So what you did was you looked at that camera, and that camera was the only thing you were talking to. You were talking to one person. When you get to a crowd of 3,500, you talk to one or two persons, okay? You know, you do not talk to all those people, or you'll go nuts. You'll go off. But if you have passion, if you have a message, you know, if you you can talk to any crowd, and they love, and they can tell when you have passion. Okay, they can tell. That's kind of what's missing in our political arena. Okay, is that passion? Everyone's so afraid to say the wrong thing that, damn it, they're saying the wrong things. Okay, people want somebody for real. Well, that's why they all wanted that Christie. You know, there's this overweight guy who doesn't give a damn, who's yelling at the unions and, you know, not giving anything and whacking away, flailing away. We want real. We've had enough hoo-ha. We're broke as a result of all this hoo-ha. Whether it's Democrat or Republican, it doesn't matter. We just want real. So when it comes to speaking about your product, you better believe in it, and you better emanate the emotion of that belief. You've got to be prepared to look in the eyes of thousands and say, this is something you need to pay attention to.
You know, that's very insightful. Since, you know, you went towards the political realm as far as public speaking, I want to ask you regarding entrepreneurship. You know, a lot of your companies had a foundation, or they have some kind of philanthropic entity that they use in the community. Does the entrepreneur need to have, particularly a small business, a philanthropic arm of their company? And if so, is that a negative or a positive for the company?
Is what a negative positive? Having public relations?
Having a non-profit, let's say like a foundation.
Oh, a non-profit. No, it's not a negative. It shouldn't be a negative at all. It should say, we're not doing this for the money. We're doing this for the belief. Now, the problem becomes some people doing a non-for-profit may not be as passionate. I don't know this answer. This answer may not be true, Prince John, okay? I don't have enough experience in it because I believe, like Michael Douglas says, is that greed is good, okay? And greed can be used as good. But I believe that if you're a nonprofit and you approach me and you're not-for-profit, my initial reaction is that there's no reason for me not to believe in you, except maybe you get too high a salary in that not-for-profit. Okay? So it should have a positive impact. But some of these not-for-profits, because of my experience, for instance, the American Diabetes Association, what a bunch of baloney. It's like the Red Cross. Some of these not-for-profits spend so much money on buildings and salaries and infrastructure that it doesn't get to the diabetics. It doesn't get to the victims, okay? So there is this stimulus generalization, I call it, from psychology, that says, well, if the American Diabetes Association, even their chapters don't like them, is not going to spend the money on diabetes research, but really going to spend the money on salaries and buildings, or the Red Cross is not going to do what they said they're going to do in Haiti, okay? Then, even though they're not for profit, okay, are they believable? Okay? So that's the negative side of not for profit. The positive side is, that the foundation of the company is the goal of the company is strictly, hopefully, to help somebody or some group better themselves or their situation without making money off that endeavor. And that's a tough one. Right?
Yeah, it really is. Because you're making me think about some of the dissatisfaction, you know, with the United States, the comments you made about people want someone or something that's real in some levels.
Yeah,
so now I want to take us to the global economy. I want to ask you, for the entrepreneur in the global economy, they're looking at the United States and they're very concerned for a number of reasons. They're concerned about the debt levels. They're concerned about future taxation. What concern, and particularly, what kind of analytical process should an entrepreneur have in America regarding a new business or a business they've already been operating for some time, if any?
I hate to tell you this. I really hate to tell you this. But when I was in front of those 50 kids in Dr. Lam's class and telling them that the future of America was on their shoulders, because America was founded on risk, the risk of not being dependent on a king, the risk of not having nobles take care of us, the risk of a roughneck in Texas with a 12-inch pipe drilling with his fingers crossed behind his back. Risk is the foundation of America. And this hoo-ha about 80% of all new businesses, I've only failed once, and that was situational. That's this real estate situation. Up until then, I had 100% success rate, but that's abnormal. But even if it's true that 20% of businesses succeed and 80% of new businesses fail, the volumes that come out of those 20% far exceed the failures. Because the failures are going to fail in 1 or 2 years or whatever, maybe 3 at most. The successes are going to last for decades and with offshoots, etc. But now we face something as entrepreneurs we've never faced. You know, they talk about creating an environment for business, and I agree with them, meaning deregulation, tax situations that make us competitive, all the right things, but except for one thing, and that is funding for the startups. The startups. Do you think Steve Jobs could start his Apple company today? No way. Could Richard Wirth start Frookies today? No way. You cannot go into the bank today without the FDIC telling that banker that for every dollar that he's lending out, he better have a buck and a quarter in the bank from the same guy. And the Dodd-Frank Act, in another year or so, will make it even worse. Because of what happened with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and all the shenanigans on Wall Street that made selling mortgages more important than giving them, we're now being overregulated and there's no money for the startup. The venture capital community only wants guaranteed deals, and no good deal is guaranteed. It may be logical, the probability curve may be great, but no good deal is guaranteed, okay? They want purchase order financing, not new business, okay? And so you don't have the convertible debentures, you've got no partnerships. I mean, I'd go to a bank and say, listen, here's my track record, here's who I am, here's all my assets, take it all, I believe in this product, I'm all in, do you believe in it? They say, yes, here's my business plan, do you believe in my business plan? Look at the competitive analysis, it's all third party endorsed, my plan comes from all third party information, there is no way you can argue against it, okay? Will you invest with me? Will you give me 80% of receivables? Will you give me 50% of inventory? Will you give me a couple hundred grand for marketing? Will you give me something for public relations, third-party endorsement? That's not available until we see, we're not a manufacturing company anymore, country. That's a Freudian slip, okay? I think of us as a company, not a country. And we're not 9% manufacturing. Well, we can't compete with $2 a day, okay? You know, in India and China, Vietnam. We're not a manufacturing company. The only way we can be is an innovation company where labor costs are irrelevant. The gross margins are so high, the patents protect us, okay? That's what we have to become. Self-sufficient in energy, okay, with innovation in product. And the only way to do that is have some little wacky engineer somewhere come up with a process to create diesel out of sugarcane for 50 cents a gallon, okay, which is there, but he needs funding. There's over 1,000 patents in Oak Ridge Labs sitting there waiting for someone to take them to market. We do not have that ability today, and no one seems to be looking at that ability for tomorrow. I have a solution, but it's not appropriate for this interview, okay? It's not a government solution, but I have a solution. We do need a mutual fund for startups, period. Give them higher returns. Give them their entire investment. If they invest $100,000, have them be able to deduct it off their income tax immediately. Okay? That's just part of the plan. We need to be able to support startups so they are the foundation of America's recovery. And right now we're in the deepest trouble. I'm 63 years old. Just had my birthday. Happy birthday, Richard.
That's right.
I've never seen us in more trouble. Because once the entrepreneur who has an idea can't fund it, we are stuck.
You know, Richard, you gave a lot of wisdom right there with that response. That is so potent, particularly when you mentioned you didn't want to be beholden to a king, that the business is the backbone of the country, innovation, regulating, they can't get startup money. And you mentioned energy, which to me is very important because I don't think that in America the average person realizes just how precarious the commodity supply chain is, particularly regarding food and energy. If you would talk to us about RW Greenfields and some of the operation products and goals of this alternative energy-based company.
Well, what's on, don't believe what's on TV, okay? America has 2 billion acres of biomass. Each acre produces 120 million sustainable BTUs per year, and a half a billion plus of farmland being paid not to produce that could produce biomass at 120 million BTU per year. If you do the numbers, okay, that's more than all the Saudi and the Emirates thermal energy combined. We should be an energy exporting country, okay? You've got different places for solar, you know, but it's an ephemeral energy. Sometimes it's sunny, sometimes it ain't. Sometimes it's hot, sometimes it ain't. It works in some places. Biomass is 24/7. That's why Greenfield's focused on biomass, okay? But the funding went to people like Solandra, okay? That's what happened. We applied for grants, the funding, the banks were closed, and the funding went elsewhere. This country, its balance sheet, every year is $1 trillion to the negative because of energy. This environmentalist now is so concerned with the economic situation that I'm ready to say to Duke Power, you know what? Do your coal thing. I'm ready to say to Exxon, drill, baby, drill. I'm ready to say to, Citgo or whatever, fraction yourself to death while we're developing our alternate renewable energy sources. You got to understand, what is it about finite and infinite that people don't understand? Finite has an ending, okay? This world has a finite amount of fossil fuels. Why would you go for finite when you got infinite? However, our country's in such trouble now, we have to go for everything. Here's a green environmentalist supporting coal, supporting fuel, supporting gas, knowing full well we have to keep our eye on the real future, which is real renewable resources that do not require massive subsidies, that produce an ROI. And we know that works. For God's sakes, there are schools. People don't even realize, but the whole city of St. Paul is run on firewood. It's run on biomass. Nobody realizes it. The DOE did it when the Arabs stopped shipping us in the 70s. Did you know it? Nope. It works. In some place in Texas, they built the whole biomass system to do a whole city, Albuquerque, and then they shut it down because it worked. Okay? It's cronyism. We're going for the short buck and the short pain and the no long gain. Okay? But at this point, America needs it all. Because when you got a $14 trillion debt, boy, you can't deal with it. So, America needs it all with its focus on future. The future's got to be renewable. The present's got to be everything. We're in that much trouble when a green environmentalist starts promoting Duke Power and its coal, when the EPA is trying to shut down 20 coal plants and Richard's not for it, okay? You know we're in trouble. But we're also... The cost of the fossil fuels are much higher than people give credit to. The ozone layer is already broken, okay? The cost to us physically, okay? The cost to crops. People don't realize that in Venezuela, all the cows are half blind because they're closest to the ozone layer. It's a simple fact. So we're getting hurt. And how much does this health-related problems? Forget about global warming. Let's say that global warming is hoo-ha. The ozone layer has already been proven. Global warming, yes. Global warming, no. You know, when I asked this professor, I said, listen, if I take a 6-inch piece of ground and I put a gram of mustard on that ground for 10 years. Am I going to change that piece of ground? He said, absolutely. So common sense wise says that for the last 100 years, we've been throwing the stuff up in the air, chemicals, preservatives in our food, fossil fuel. You're going to have an effect simply by the fact that what wasn't there for 5,000 years is now there for 150 years. Okay? So it's common sense. These people are not arguing common sense because they don't want to argue common sense. There's an agenda. Now, America should be an exporting company. Within 10 years as a result, we would have no debt just from that behavior. How important is that? I ask you, Prince John.
You know, well, it's incredibly important regarding debt and the country's dependence on borrowing. The country's dependent on borrowing, and the people are. I'd like to ask you, do you have any thoughts about the Obama administration's support of alternative energy doing good things or bad?
Obama administration, who I supported, who I voted for, is it's a great disappointment. Okay? They have continuously had the emphasis on the wrong syllable. Okay? They have not delivered on their promises of transparency, cronyism. They have mismanaged. I mean, Obama himself has only been president for 2 years and is running for office for 2 years. We can't afford that, okay? The list of what he has not done correctly, with my support, I didn't like Bush, okay, at all right? I supported Obama. My family supported Obama, okay? A very great disappointment, okay? And unfortunately, he's the same political animal that he promised that he wasn't going to be. And so it's not Republicans better than Democrats or Democrats better than Republicans. He had a chance to make a difference by just telling the truth. Okay? All he had to do was say, you know what? I'm going to try to get 8% unemployment at this time, but I'm not sure I can do it. I need your help, and let's reach across the table. I mean, you know, you just don't keep saying you're doing a good job when it's not happening, okay? And his whole metaphysic on government central planning, which I did not know was coming down the pike, has never worked. Government central economic planning has never worked. It didn't work in the Soviet Union. It did help in from the Weimar Republic to Hitler, but it's never worked. It's the entrepreneurs. We come back again to wherever the entrepreneurs are strong, where the individual is able to make a difference. That's what counts. And centralized Keynesian trickle-down economics does not work. And making people reliant on the government does not work. This class warfare, I mean, Prince John, I'm sorry, there's just too many things wrong. I can't even start the list, okay? And let's put it this way. I never watched Fox News before Obama. Never. I was a liberal. A guilty liberal. You know? And he turned me into a right winger. A small C conservative. Okay? But you know what? Maybe that's a good lesson for America. And I'm not praising the Republicans. I'm not. I mean, they've done their share every time. You know, they've done their share. But this was a great, you know, it's a funny expression because he's not white, but he was the great white hope to change things, right? He was back in the 40s, I guess, against Joe Lewis. It was the great white hope or whatever. I think it was the German fighter. But he was the great hope to unify this country, not to play political games, to be transparent. And, you know, how many people still know what this Obamacare really means? When Nancy Pelosi said, you've got to read it in order to, you need to pass it so you can read it. That was the most real thing that this administration has said. But the doctors know what it means. I'm stuttering. Okay, and we're in terrible shape. Terrible, terrible shape. We need a complete change and hands off in government, and let the people, hopefully from this class that you and I are in, okay, have an effect. I would ask you, as the interviewer, how How's it working for you?
I mean, you taking not the words out of my mouth, but you get the essence of my being with your response to that last question.
I'm not supposed to do that as the interviewee, but I had to.
It makes sense because you are right. I would say that Obama represented an unprecedented opportunity that hasn't existed since the 60s when King was alive and Kennedy, particularly Robert Kennedy. And that currency, that great promise of America, has in many ways been squandered and actually made negative.
The very fact is that, you know, they say it's 17%. You know, when you hit the real estate industry, okay, in this country, which is 27% of the GMP, and that's what Dexter did, okay, in his real estate hoo-ha package, okay? When you hit that, your unemployment rate is not 9%. It's 18, okay? Because you have shopkeepers, like antique shopkeepers, or lighting people, or realtors who aren't even on the employee rolls. I mean, you have so many underemployed and unemployed people that not even the Unemployment Insurance Commission, when you call them, they admit it. And in the minority community has been hit the hardest. They say it's 17% unemployment. I don't believe it. I believe it's 25. What do you think?
Absolutely. It's underreported, misreported, and most certainly higher, particularly for minority males, you know, black males, most certainly. And I would ask you, as we tie up, I want to ask this question. Based on what you just said regarding the state of the nation and the opportunity, what advice would you give to those who are entrepreneurs right now or thinking about becoming an entrepreneur, given the economic climate and situation of the United States and the rise of China and Asia?
You're going to have to be a lot sharper than you ever would have to be. You're going to have to line up financing in a more creative way than you ever had to. You're going to have more efficiencies than you've ever had to. Your USP is going to stand out, or technology is going to stand out more than you've ever had to. And you can't be off the seat of the pants. I mean, there was one interview that I think that you and I think talked when we first talked about. Here's a lady going into her business. She has no money, and it's her first month in business. She's got no cushion. I mean, that's not going to work, okay? You know, my recommendation is about a year and a half. Have a year and a half of money. You're going to have to be, your capital requirements for the business have to be in place in a very creative way, whether it's family and friends or whether it's an unusual banking relationship or whether it's, however you can get that. It's very different. It's going to be much more challenging. I'm sorry. I don't have the magic wand. I think it's all the above. And you've got to have a product that's very interesting that should be focused on right now, unfortunately, is on misery. Products that will work right currently now is based on other people's pain.
That's
okay?
Right.
Like, for instance, collections, you know? Or I noticed the other day that U-Haul is hiring. Well, why? Why is U-Haul hiring? Because everyone's being thrown out of their house, okay? Or they're being thrown out of their apartments because they can't afford it. I'm sorry to say that in an idealistic world, to have a positive product that has a positive impact. But also, I want to make your people, you and whoever this goes to, aware of, is the misery factory. Okay? Is that wherever there is misery, there's business to be had. If your company solves the misery factor, if your company helps with cash flow, if your company works on like a variable speed drill, for instance, says I'll come in here for nothing, and but if I make your company more successful, you pay me more than usual. Okay, you're going to have to be very creative. Okay, and that's what I call the misery. I've never approached the misery route. I've always approached the better than route. So it's very difficult for me, Prince John, to advise this. I never have in 60 years, but that is a factor. And the first factor, I said again, is to be very, very sure of your capital base. Your ideas, your brilliant ideas will not cut it without capitalization. And you've got to make sure, and the word less than comes into play too. Despite the fact that they say there's no inflation, they're absolutely nuts. When was the last time you were in a grocery store?
Right.
Inflation is wicked. To buy a pipe right now for a wood cook stove costs 15% than it did 2 weeks ago. Who are we kidding about inflation? Okay? So there's a lot of the, you know, there's a lot. What I'm saying is that entrepreneurialism is our savior, but it's tougher. It's going to be tougher than it's ever been, but the winners are going to win more than they ever have, too. That's the positive.
Well, I think that that's a powerful point, lesson, and message to end on. Mr. Worth, this interview could go on for another 5 hours.
That's and because
like
I think we like each other.
And just keep going up. Being great, wonderful. With that, I'm going to conclude our interview with just a little bit of a treat for those who are going to hear this. If you would tell us, what is the essence of an entrepreneur? But I got a test for you in only 20 words.
You just knocked me out of the park, Prince John. you found my weakness, didn't you? Yeah, you're terrible. You're evil, wicked, mean, and nasty. The essence of an entrepreneur in 20 years. In 20, yeah. No, it's not in 20 years. It's in 20 words. Okay, let's see. You have to get to know your customers, okay? You have to know your customers. You have to level the playing field with either product or technology. You have to build a top-notch business team. You have to create a USP, a competitive advantage. You have to plan everything and make your money, manage your money extremely wisely. You have to ask for the sale, my friend. If you don't ask for the sale, get out. You have to be, I don't know how many I've done so far.
You passed 20, but it's good stuff.
You have to have partnership. You have to, with your customers and with your own team, okay? You have to have attitude. Attitude equals altitude. Attitude equals altitude. You have to conservatively capitalize your plan and identify your strengths and plan on compensating for your weaknesses. You have to motivate and inspire employees and customers. and you have to have the company systems and checks and balance implementation so that your company never runs out of control and your product knowledge can be second to none. And your packaging and your point of purchase must create an instant, emotive, and rational desire to respond with a purchase.
Okay.
And I think that's 20.
That's very powerful. That's more than 20, but because it was all good, I'm not going to fuss it all.
You were counting?
Mr. Word, that was fantastic. We want to thank you for that that interview. That's powerful. And at this moment, I'm going to stop recording. All right, Richard, that was fantastic, man.
Well, you made it easy. I mean, you were so positive. I mean, honestly, you know, I hope it was for real, but I got to tell you that your approach to me let me be who I am. And you know, I even looked forward to you interrupting me. Okay? You know, you were really good. You were a good interviewer. And I don't think we lasted over an hour, did we?
We did, but you know what? That was
how long
so
did we
good.
Last?
About an hour and 4 minutes.
That's exactly what they wanted. Do you know that?
There were so many gems in that interview. That is the value of that. We could sell that.
Maybe that's what we should do. Okay.
Well, you know, we really could, because that hit a lot of the landscape of entrepreneurship at home and abroad. That's very powerful right there. What I'm going to do is, this is recorded, it's downloaded. What I'm going to do is, I'm going to send you a copy of it for your records. What I want you to do is, give me 5 minutes and call me back, and then you can interview me.
Yeah, but you've exhausted me, damn you. you've killed me. I made the wrong choice. I should have interviewed you first.
Hey, whatever. You're a superhero like Superman. You might have got knocked down, but you'll be back.
Yeah. Okay, let me get a cup of coffee here and give me, by the way, Prince Rez, what are you a prince of?
The prince came from my family's faith in the Lord, as well as the last name Eli. A lot of people of African descent who were Americans, they took issue with the slave name. My issue was that my identity was rooted in something greater than the flesh. And my father said, you're exactly right. So the prince became a recognition of God, and the Eli became an anointing of his name.
No, don't tell me anymore, because this is part of the interview, okay?
Okay.
It's too interesting. All right, give me 10 minutes, and I hate your guts for making me exhausted, okay?
All right, I said 11 minutes,
right,
because
so
we're kind of okay.
I'm going to call you in 10 minutes, okay?
Okay.
All right?